Hi, everybody. Today is Tuesday, July 29th, 2025, and our friend Carmel Wilkerson is back with us. Welcome back, Larry.
Good to be back with you. Seems like we're meeting every week now.
Yeah. Carmel, I want to start with what Donald Trump said about the hostages in Gaza. Here is what he said.
Into Bibi Netanyahu, and we are coming up with various plans. We're going to see. It's a very difficult situation. If they didn't have the hostages, things would go very quickly. But they do, and we know where they have them in some cases. And you don't want to go riding roughshod over that area because that means those hostages will be killed. Now, there are some people that would say, well, that's the price you pay. But we don't like to say that. We don't want to say that. And I don't think.
Yeah, if they didn't have the hostages, that would be different. How and in what way that would be different?
They'd kill them faster. If they didn't have the hostages, they'd kill them faster. Although I'm not quite sure how, with this starvation that's taking place now and what they're doing around the humanitarian aid dispensation sites, killing people who are coming for food and water. I don't know how you could go much faster, but it probably would go a little faster because it wouldn't have to worry about the hostages dying when the Israelis blunderbuss their way into a particular area or facility. But it would make no difference. And that just shows how detached at best and how ignorant at worst. And I fear the latter is the case. Donald Trump is about this situation. And his comments about starvation indicate that he's totally out of the loop too. If he's being truthful. I mean, there's supposed to be comments that finally indicate that Donald Trump maybe has some objections to what Bibi Netanyahu is doing. Well, I'm sorry, Mr. President. It's far worse than just the little bit of starvation that you began to admit to, apparently, because you've seen some scenes that escaped Bibi's propaganda mechanism and got out and you were able to see them. But this is building into a tumult of information that's coming out because a lot of people are seeing it or hearing about it from people whom they trust, and they're reporting on it. And it's not least of which that we have, and I've talked with one or two of them, we have some actual former military people who've gone over there in various capacities, and they're reporting on what they're seeing, to include, as we were discussing before we went on the air, to include IDF soldiers picking out particular people coming to the humanitarian aid disposition point and targeting various parts of the individuals whom they're shooting and killing, to include their testicles, and taking great joy in doing it. No wonder the PTSD ranks in the IDF are increasing on a daily basis. I mean, if they're doing this sort of thing and other soldiers who might not have the same relish for doing that sort of thing, but are nonetheless seeing their compatriots do it, that's what builds your post-traumatic stress ranks, is you're standing there watching your fellow soldiers take joy and delight in shooting the testicles of human beings.
Larry, here is what the former U.S. Green Beret, Anthony Ankelor, said from his experience in Gaza.
25 years, I've been shot 3 times in combat. I'm pretty tough. This gets me every time because to what you're saying, the dehumanization. And what I want to say to the American people and to the people of Israel, I've been there. I have touched them. I have talked to them. The civilians in Gaza that are getting the food, they are starving. They are not animals. They are human beings. And they're being treated like animals. We treat these civilians in Gaza worse, with less dignity than we treated the ISIS fighters that surrendered in Baghouz Faghani in Syria in 2018. This young boy, this is on May 28th, on secure distribution site number 2. The aid had been distributed. A lot of people had left. You see behind, there's a crowd of people still with their boxes, kind of getting ready to leave. And this little boy, his name is Amir, And he was standing, you know, he was with the crowd, but he walks over and you see that first picture on the top right. He kind of walks over to me and he puts out his hand. And at first I thought like that he wanted more food or something. And I felt bad because I didn't have anything, but I was like, oh, I have nothing. And he puts out his hand. And so I beckoned him to come to me. I said, you know, come here. And he reaches out and he holds my hand and he kisses my hand. He kisses my hand and he says, Shukran. You can see in this picture that this little boy is not wearing shoes. His clothes are falling off of him because he's so skinny. I put my hand on his left shoulder and I looked at him and he's looking at me. We're looking at each other in the eyes. And I say to him, people care. You're a human being and people care about you. The world cares. That's not Hamas. That's not a Hamas fighter. And I looked at him and I said, the world cares.
The kid was killed, Colonel, and then he mentions that after he leaves the kid, he get killed by IDF. And you know, we don't have people there to everyday report on what's going on in Gaza, but from the scenes, from pictures, from the videos, we're learning what's going on there.
Yes, and we're hearing from other people like that gentleman there. But I've been hearing this from, for example, Doctors Against Genocide, who have been in Rafah, who have been in Khan Yunis, who have been in surgical wards, who, if you can call them surgical wards, they're usually just a table with a cloth and, you know, maybe a few facilities around, a scalpel or two. And I've been there when I've listened to them talk about these are surgeons, nurses, practical nurses, nursing assistants, medical personnel in general. And I've listened to them talk with one another, and they've talked with me in the Congress of the United States in front of the one or two congresspersons like Joe Green of Texas who would allow us to come in his office. And I've listened to them tell their stories about the horrors of being in that facility with those people at that time, under the conditions they were under and the danger they were confronting. I mean, I have nothing but respect for these doctors and nurses to have gone in there knowing that they were just as apt to lose their lives as were their patients. So this is not new to me. And I hope people listening to me now will understand why I've grown increasingly angry with this little statelet, this heinous little statelet called Israel and its ruler, the Adolf Hitler of the present day, named Bibi Netanyahu, because that's all I can call him. This is as bad as anything Hitler ever did. I'm sorry, people. It's as bad as anything Hitler ever did.
Carl, do you understand when it comes to the attitude of the French government? They were talking, they had a meeting with the Saudi Arabia, with the King of Saudi, with the Foreign Minister of Saudi Arabia. They were talking about some sort of two-state solution. At this stage of what's going on in Gaza, how can they talk about two-state solution? And we know that the West Bank, Israel is capturing all the West Bank and nobody knows what would happen to Gaza. But how can you, when you see what's going on in Gaza, you talk about two-state solution, and Netanyahu doesn't care about what these people are talking about. And it doesn't seem that the president of the United States, Donald Trump, is caring about anything.
Nor does Macron or Starmer or any of these other people who, under the political pressure that's created by what's coming out now, and I suspect more and more of it's going to come out because Netanyahu's losing his grip on being able to stop everything from falling out of Israel. He's got groups within Israel now that are saying he's heinous and what he's doing is heinous. He's got groups within Israel, human rights groups, that are suddenly saying, some of them have been saying all along, but now are getting publicity and saying it, that this is terrible what Israel is doing and that they will rue the day that they did it because they'll never be able to live with this as time goes by. this is all happening. So you got the British, you got the French, you got others in the world, even the Arab countries now, who can't stand this sort of thing flowing out and know it's going to get worse. There's going to be a deluge of this. They're trying to compensate now. They're trying to say things that are positive. They're weak things. Oh, says Macron, we're going to recognize Palestine as a state, but in September. And then you got other people. But this is all trying to assuage the guilt that they feel. They don't mean any of this. It's all politically expedient because much of the things coming out now are going to damage their reputations eternally, eventually. And so they're trying to take reactive action to compensate for that a little bit and maybe assuage it a little bit. I'm sorry, it's not going to work because this is going to be, you know, when Eisenhower and Patton and others went into the death camps at the end of World War II and showed those images and showed the American people and others in the world what Hitler had actually done in those death camps, there was a revulsion across the world that developed. But it shouldn't have been like that because we knew it was going on. We knew it was happening. Maybe we didn't know it to the depth of when Patton walked through one of those camps or Eisenhower walked through one of those camps, but we certainly knew it. And when it sprung on the world was shocked, absolutely shocked. And that's what really prompted a lot of the things that happened at Nuremberg and the trials and so forth. We got away with it. We were the conquering power. We could get away with it. But the world's revulsion was palpable. Well, that's where we are now. We're getting to that point now with Israel. And it's every bit as bad as anything Hitler did in Dachau, Auschwitz, Treblinka, or anywhere else in the death camps. And people are going to realize that eventually. Political leaders are going to try to backfill and compensate. And that's what you're seeing now. It's beginning now.
Colonel, I really believe that with the case of starvation, at least with the case of starvation, the United States can do something, can change what's going on in Gaza. And here is what Donald Trump said about the starvation and the role of the United States, what they can do about it.
I think people would have starved. Will I do more aid? Yeah. The U.S.? The U.S. is going to do more aid for Gaza. But we'd like to have other countries participate. We're going to mention that to the European Union today. That's an international problem. It's not a U.S. problem. It's an international problem. And we're giving a lot of money and a lot of food and a lot of everything. If we weren't there, I think people would have starved, frankly. They would have starved. And it's not like they're eating well. But a lot of that food is getting stolen by Hamas. You know, they're stealing the food. They're stealing a lot of things. You ship it in and they steal it. Then they sell it.
Does he know that people are dying because of starvation?
He's listening to Bibi. He's listening to Bibi. He's listening to Miller. He's listening to other people who are listening to our ambassador in Israel. He's listening to all these people who are lying Netanyahu's lies to him. And he's listening to Bibi, who's nothing but a serial liar. If he really cared, he could do what he's intimating there the United States is doing, which we are not. But he could. He could put more food on the ground in Israel in a shorter period of time than anybody else in the world. Quit asking others to do it, Donald. Quit asking others to ease and salve your conscience. Quit asking others to relieve the empire of its total and utter complicity in everything Netanyahu is doing. Just do it, you damn idiot. You could put food on the ground quick. These airplanes dropping food and everything, in addition to being dangerous, you know, pallets landing on people's heads and killing them, and it doesn't take much to kill these people because they can't hardly lift their own foot and walk. They're starving to death. That doesn't help much. You could drive Netanyahu to allow those trucks in. You need 500 trucks a day minimum. You could make that happen. Quit begging others to do it for you, you sorry son of a bitch. Put the food on the ground and stop this bastard Netanyahu from killing these people using food as a weapon of war, which is a number one war crime. You could do it, but you won't because you're an idiot. You're a clown.
Colonel, do you think that the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Starmer, did they talk about it? What is the position of the United Kingdom in what's going on with this starvation? We know that European leaders talking about it. It seems that they're more informed about what's going on in Gaza. It's not like Donald Trump. He feels that that people are not dying because of starvation. Yeah. They know what's going on.
Get off your ass and do it. If I were Starmer and I saw the images I've seen and know what I know now, and he can't be ignorant of it. He simply can't be ignorant of it. Put a damn British regiment on the ground. Put it on the ground right there in the Philadelphia corridor. Put it on the ground in Egypt. Put it somewhere with food and go in there and tell the IDF, I'll shoot your goddamn ass if you try to stop me. Do something. Tell the United States, you've got a military, you use your military too. Trump begging others to do what they need to do. Get your military over there. Shoot those damn IDF soldiers.
Netanyahu, Colonel, we have to mention him because we have to understand what's the rhetoric on the part of Netanyahu and his administration. They're trying to say that there is no starvation. Whatever goes in Gaza, Hamas is still all of them. And let me play what he said.
No starvation in Gaza, no policy of starvation in Gaza. And I assure you that we have a commitment to achieve our war goals. We'll continue to fight till we achieve the release of our hostages and the destruction of Hamas's military and governing capabilities. They shall be there no more. We shall not have any more of these massacres. We shall not have any more of these monstrosities. We stand for human freedom and human life, and that is not commensurate with Hamas or with Iran, other Iranian proxies. We have fought this battle together. We shall win it together.
Yeah. I got news for him. He is not commensurate with human life. He is certainly not commensurate with human kindness, human generosity, and the rule of law. Listen to him using the regal, we shall, we shall, we shall. He sounds like Louis XVI. He is the guilty party here, enormously so. He is as guilty as Adolf Hitler and his right-hand man, Reinhard Heydrich, ever was. He is as guilty as Hitler ever was. He is slaughtering people. He is using food as a tool of warfare. He's killing them to the tune of Nima, 200,000 people so far, minimum, half of whom are women and children. And what he's talking about is eradicating the Palestinians so that Smotrich and his boys, who are already there, can start building settlements in Gaza. That's his solution, ultimately. And any residual Palestinians will either be murdered or they'll be pushed off the land. That's his solution. That's what he's aiming for. Now, here's the key, too, to what he was just saying, security-wise. He has not eliminated Hamas. The IDF, in all these atrocities, in all this using food as a weapon of war, has not eliminated Hamas. They are still there. They are still coherent. They're still able to fight, just as is remnants of Hezbollah in Lebanon. And when the time comes and when Israel is truly hard-pressed, and you know how hard-pressed they could be if they resume this war with Iran, the word is finally getting out all through the region. People in Azerbaijan, people in Armenia, people in other places in the region now understand what happened to Israel in the 12-day beautiful war. And they understand that there is another force in that region, not China, not Russia, but Iran, which can take Israel on and do irreparable damage to it. that is probably as powerful an instrument to deter Netanyahu as there ever was, once it gets really thoroughly understood. Unfortunately, he's operating on another area now. He's operating in Syria, he's operating in Gaza and the West Bank. And he knows he has a free hand, at least in the West Bank and Gaza, not necessarily in Syria. That could come to some real problems for him. But he certainly has a, and where is he killing people with the greatest ferocity? In the places where he has a free hand, West Bank and Gaza. And who is aiding and abetting that process? Donald J. Trump and the United States of America. So this is a shrewd evil man. This is not a stupid evil man. He's shrewd, politically and otherwise. Look at what he just did to get Smotrich to stay in his party. He essentially told Smotrich, you got it, baby. You got it. You know, you've got the West Bank. Well, you got Gaza now. Get your shovels ready. Get your bulldozers ready. Get everything ready, because a lot of rubble out there, but you're going to populate Gaza. You're going to populate Gaza, and we're going to leave remnants of the IDF there to take care of you in terms of security. We're going to populate Gaza. Gaza's ours now. You happy, Smotrich? Now you'll stay in the coalition? Yeah. That's how they operate, Nima. That's what they're doing. And God bless the few people who are coming out in Israel now, like these human rights organizations. But I have to say that probably 65 to 70, maybe even 80% of the Jewish Israelis are very, very content with what Netanyahu is planning for Gaza. That's a hell of a comment on the Israeli citizens who are Jewish. A hell of a comment. It just reminds me again of Joseph Avassar's comment that a Jewish state is not good for Jews. It is not good for Jews. Any kind of theocratic state, in my mind, is not good for the people who compose the theocracy. Religion is not something to build a government on. But in this case, Israel, it's a bloody, bloody religion.
Larry, Brazil withdrew from the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance shortly after joining South Africa's case against Israel. When it comes to here in Brazil, we know that the tone, the government, Lula, has somehow is moving the way that we haven't seen before. He's trying to do something with the case of Israel. But do you feel that this sort of attitude would be pursued, would be the case for the other Latin America governments? Or
yes, absolutely. I do. And I'll frankly, Nima, I am surprised, and I still expect to see more of this, but I'm surprised that countries in the world who are neutral, let's say, or countries in the world who were friendly or even allied with, not formally, but allied with in economics, trade, and other matters of importance, the United States, aren't thinking about this more seriously. The empire is extraordinarily vulnerable right now. And where it is vulnerable most is not Ukraine. It's vulnerable there too, but not to the degree it is in the Levant. Extremely vulnerable, both to propaganda, and I mean positive propaganda. I don't mean that term derisively, and to actual use of power, economic, trade, military even. It's as vulnerable as it's ever been before. So if you are looking for opportunity to slide into some of the slivers of vulnerability that the empire is showing now, there is no more propitious place to do so than Gaza. Whether you flow in with your diplomacy and your comments and your commentary, or whether you flow in with actual power, like trade power, economic power, and so forth, and you suddenly, for example, say, as a couple of countries have, we're not trading with Israel anymore, period. We're not trading with Israel at all, period. I'm not meaning next week or next month. I'm meaning right now to the indefinite future. We're not trading with Israel. If more countries would do that, and cite the United States when they do it, and maybe even take some action against the United States with that regard too. How about sanctioning us? Would it mean anything? No, perhaps not if only one little country did it, or two or three. But if half the world did it, we would have to wake up and acknowledge that we're, at least in some ways, wrong. I don't see why more countries have not picked up and flowed into these crevices of weakness that the empire is showing right now. I credit Lula. He's a smart man if he's trying to do that. And anyone else in Latin America who wants to do that, because of all the people in the Western Hemisphere who have grievances against the United States, look at what we've done in the Western Hemisphere, even in Chile, in Guatemala, in Honduras, and other places. They are the ones who should be doing it. They're frightened of doing it, I know, because we still have some residual economic power. We still have some, shall we say, predatory capitalist corporations, which are located in key areas of Buenos Aires and other places in Latin America. But now's the time. Now's the time. Jump on the bandwagon. Start doing things that oppose the empire gone amok. And I'm not just saying that from a perspective of the present time. I'm saying it from the overall perspective of what I've talked to you a lot of times about before. Power is shifting, and it's shifting dramatically. And it's shifting because the world is shifting toward China, toward Central Asia, toward Russia now, as it has allied itself with China. Russia has always been a big power sitting there on a massive landmass, trying to figure out which way it wanted to go, east or west, east or west. Do I want to go south? Looking south a lot now with the Caucasus and other things kind of cooking. But the real impetus is east and west. And now the power is flowing eastward. And everyone that understands that is going to come out a whole lot better than those who don't understand that, because those who understand it can accommodate it. Those who don't understand it are going to fight it. Let me read you something. I don't want to bore your listeners, but this is something I wrote right after I had read Frankopan's book, The New Silk Roads. And I'd read Hugh Pope's book, Sons of the Conquerors. These are two fantastic books that everyone ought to try to get a hold of and read. This is something I wrote in a long piece I did on it. Quote, if you look in, this is in Sons of Conquerors, Hugh Pope's book, the pictures in that book. There's one picture. It's on page, there's 16 pages of pictures, and the pictures themselves aren't numbered. So it's between page 224 and 225. And here's a quote underneath a photo. The eagle has landed. This is where wary Kazakh police watched the first U.S. paratroopers to land in Central Asia. Those police had no idea what a momentous event they were observing. The first effort to stop this power shift. We might guess it would be a military effort, since today's American empire is fundamentally limited by imperial choice to only two instruments of state power, the military and economic sanctions. This is what I put in the paper after looking at those photographs. Those Kazakh policemen were witnessing the first American effort to stop this. And that's what we're talking about now. Even in the Levant, that's what we're talking about, because the Southern Base Road Initiative for China depends on Iran. That's what we're doing. The empire is trying to stop the Northern Base Road Initiative, the Southern Base Road Initiative, Central Base Road Initiative, which is Ukraine, proxy war with Russia, and the Southern one, which depends on Ukraine or on Iran. Now we've got one developing, a fourth one developing, because the Chinese are now trying to get into the Arctic in a significant way. We got one developing along that Northwest Passage, if it is to be actually commercially successful. And of course, who's along most of that passage? Russia. By far, they're along most of the part of that passage that'll be serious and close to land. So we're looking at this game going on, Nima. This is the great game going on again with a few different players. And the American empire is trying to maintain its imperial reach, and it's failing. So all to say, countries need to line up appropriately, or they're going to be left, or they're going to get caught in the wake of the disappearing empire. Now, if the empire were smart, if Washington were smart, if we didn't have a circus in Washington with the center ring featuring the main clown, Donald J. Trump, and on the left in the subsidiary ring, you know, three-ring circus, you have Marco Rubio, and on the right, you have Pete Hegseth. But it's all a circus with no strategy, no policy of significance, and no smartness how to execute either if it had it. So that's where we are now, with an empire that's falling apart and the rest of the world trying to figure out where to go. Now, the empire doesn't have to fall apart. If we had small leadership, we could accommodate what's happening in the world, much the way other countries had to accommodate the shift when it went to us. Now, Britain and France and Spain weren't too good at accommodating that. They fought it all along, but they finally had to accommodate it. The British fought it hardest of all. All to say that the world is changing. It's shifting. The Western Hemisphere is going to be a backwater. South America needs to realize it doesn't want to be a part of that backwater. So it's got to do things differently. And it's got to take itself out of being on the tit of the El Coloso del Norte, the giant in the north. It's that simple, and it's that complex also, of course. And as I've said many times, the complicating factor is that the empire has nuclear weapons, 6,000 warheads. What will we do when we wake up to the fact we have a three-ring circus in Washington and we're losing? What will we do? That's the question of the 21st century in my mind. What will the empire do when it has a leadership that realizes what's happening, really realize it? Not the billionaires behind the leadership. They know it's happening. They're part of the reason Trump is there, because they orchestrated his presence there. But if you really want to do something about it, you have to use different instruments than the military and sanctions. You have to use your brain too. And you have to think about a strategy that would accommodate what's happening, and accommodate it in a way that's beneficial to you. We're not doing that, Nima. And as long as we don't do that, then people like Lula, who are smart enough to figure this out, even if they just intuit it, they're going to continue to do things differently. And they're going to join the BRICS, as it were, you know, or they're going to be in some other consortium in order to ride out the end of the empire. This is tragic for an 80-year-old man like me who devoted his life to this empire in uniform for 31 of those years, to see this happening, to see my country falling apart in front of my face and doing things like supporting the Israelis, using the Israelis. You know, my view is we use them. They don't use us. We're using them to do what we need to do, our dirty work in the Levant. Well, we don't need to be doing that. Let that road go through. Let Iran prosper. Let the Chinese prosper. Let all the people in that region benefit from the number one economic power in the world building routes into their midst. Let that happen. Take advantage of it yourself. You're not broken down so badly you can't do something yourself that's positive. But we don't believe that. We believe we have to fight it tooth and nail. And we will. We'll fight it tooth and nail. And ultimately, we'll fight it with nuclear weapons. This guy, this general that talked about Kaliningrad, Donahue, he's a moron. I go back to Bruce Clark and Sanvith in the Battle of the Bulge, when the Germans broke through and took 16,000 American soldiers prisoners in 10 hours. The Golden Lions division surrendered entirely to the Germans. And we were holding out at Sanvith. And Sanvith was a newly minted brigadier general, Bruce Clark, who was holding off the 5th Panzer Army and the 6th Panzer Army with his tiny little group that he formed there. Ad hoc group that he formed. And in flies an airborne general, Matthew Ridgway, and tells him to do this: round up the troops and put them all in a circle and fight the German armored armies with troops in a circle. Clark tells him, get on your airplane, go. I'm not doing that. and then fights 5 or 6 days of an active defense and pretty much destroys the ability of the Germans to get to Antwerp, the port they were after, fast enough. Well, that's the kind of general that Donahue is. He's a former 18th Airborne Corps commander, and he believes that Kaliningrad can be taken by his airborne troops, you know, with Ukrainian help. He's got Ukrainians helping him. This is insanity, Nima. Insanity. You do that to the Russians, you have started World War III. I think we're already in it, as I've said, but you have started it precipitously. You started it overnight if you do that. And yet here's an army general who supposedly has a head with a brain in it up there saying that we could take Leningrad from the Russians anytime we wanted to. And his senior commander back in Heidelberg or Stuttgart, wherever they are now, is going along with it. This is insanity, Nima. You're inviting Putin to participate with you in World War III and to beat your ass.
Larry, with the case of Azerbaijan and Armenia, do you feel that they're heading toward some sort of conflict that would remind us the conflict in Georgia, or maybe somehow connected with Ukraine? Because the way that Armenia, it's a little country, it's not that big, it's not, the population is small, and they're trying to make some sort of confusion for themselves.
Yeah, they got a problem with, you know, Erdogan. They got a problem with Syria now. They got a problem with Iran. They got a problem with maybe even ultimately with Georgia, if Georgia maintains that government that they have right now, which is very balanced, doesn't want to be too close to NATO, doesn't want to be too close to Russia, wants to maintain a balance, which is smart, very, very smart. But they're caught in this mess that's associated with the new trade route, if you will. The Caspian, Baku, all of that area is very, very pregnant once again. And I use that term guardedly and carefully because that was, remember what I just read you? That's where those dudes landed, essentially. There's more natural gas and oil under the Caspian Sea, more than enough to run Central Asia for the rest of eternity. Now, that doesn't factor in climate change, but this is where the wealth is. This is where the future is. And you're in the middle of it, and you've got Iran now having proven itself as being a lot more capable than anybody else thought. You've got the empire still talking to you about how they are the most capable country. And so Armenia, Azerbaijan, those border states, if you will, have got to figure out, what do we want to do? Do we want to keep up with this internecine fighting of one another, which they love to do, or do we want to kind of check our six and check our flanks and look around and say, okay, Iran's powerful now. Iran can take care of us on its own if it wants to, take care of us in terms of military power if it wants to. Russians can certainly take care of us if they want to. The United States is miles and miles away and collapsing. It's broke. It's so broke. If you sold the United States tomorrow morning, got money for every physical asset the United States has, you wouldn't be able to pay the debt off. That's how broke we are. They need to figure out what the real power in the world is and then adjust themselves to that power. And I would recommend to them that they think really hard about the power of Russia and about the power of China, because that is what they are going to ultimately have to contend with. And forget Ankara. And forget Washington. You're going to be on the wrong side of the ball game. You need to think about Tehran, Beijing, and Moscow, and less so about your immediate surroundings, because your immediate surroundings will get you murdered. Whereas good relations with those three power centers will protect you. That's the equation now. That is the equation now. Quit listening to Washington, quit listening to Berlin, quit listening to Paris, quit listening to London. That's not the power. The power's the other way, up that way, east and north. That's where the power is. And if you don't believe it, wait until Russia gets through with Ukraine and turns its eye to you.
Larry, we had Donald Trump. He said that Iran has been very nasty with their words. They are still talking about enrichment after getting a beating.
You bet.
Who?
Enrichment and a bomb, probably. You know how I feel.
Yeah. Who does that? We won't allow it, the enrichment he's talking about. And we had the Iranian foreign minister responding to Donald Trump, at least as I know, the first time he's
Araghchi.
Just yeah. directly Araghchi. Araghchi yeah. is talking, he's responding to Donald Trump. That's Iran knows the extent of the damage that it caused on the United States and Israel. It doesn't matter how much you're censoring the news. And if aggression is repeated, we will not hesitate to react in a more decisive manner and in a way that will be impossible to cover up. And this is the first time I see Araghchi talking this way, Larry.
Iranian people didn't like too much the way the president and he were talking.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know how I think. I think they are playing a game back against us. I think they're playing the game, the president giving his speech, the foreign minister talking the way he did initially, pissing the Iranian people off. I think they're playing a game. I think they're dissembling to a certain extent. And the diplomatic track is just as we used it against them and then murdered their people at home in their beds, just as we did that, they're going to turn the tables on us. I think they've already made a decision. I think they're going to have a nuclear weapon. And I take Ted Postol to heart when he tells me that they could have one very, very quickly. Very, very quickly.
Yeah. Actually, I talked with Ted. He mentioned, he described why is that the case. And he said, if they want to go after nuclear weapons, they're going to get it.
Yep.
By the way.
And they can do just like the North Koreans did. I've said this a number of times. They tested, the North Koreans tested, and we didn't even know they tested. We got signals from the seismic center in Geneva that there'd been an event, and they couldn't put their finger on what it was. Was it an earthquake? What was it? And so we said, wow. We know what happened with Kang Sok-ju and Yi Gun and Pyongyang when our assistant secretary talked with them, and they looked at him and said, we already have nuclear weapons. Jim Kelly almost fell off his chair. We already have nuclear weapons. Well, then we said, oh God, they must have tested. So then we put everything up, our sniffer aircraft and everything else. In the second test, we actually identified. The Iranians could do the same thing. They have deep underground areas where they could test too. And then, maybe they wouldn't even need to test. They would go ahead and trust their, their technicians and so forth. You can do a number of things with computers. They're very sophisticated. You can tell if your system's going to work more or less with computers, but you really probably should do a test if you want to be really certain that what you've got is workable. They could do it underground. We wouldn't even know it. And then they just present it to us as a fait accompli. Do you think anyone would challenge them? I doubt it very seriously. You'd have the clown in the White House, the clown in their center ring. He would make some statement about, we're going to put 20 of our nuclear weapons on alert and we're going to target them on Tehran, blah, 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 blah. Well, go ahead, Donald. Let's see what you think once Iran has a nuclear weapon.
Did you see the news in the on CNN? It says that the United States has used 25% of THAAD missiles during the 12 days of war between Israel and Iran.
Of THAAD?
How amazing, 25%. How
of,
can you?
Of THAAD?
Of THAAD.
Yeah. I don't doubt it for a heartbeat, and I don't doubt either that Doug McGregor and Scott Ritter and others are right. I haven't done the research on it that they have, but I don't doubt that they're right, that Lockheed Martin and RTX and others that do this sort of thing for our government or our industrial base, if you will, defense industrial base, they can't even come close to China or Russia. And more importantly, they can't come close to the kinds of things are being done in Ukraine right now. So, I mean, if Russia can make, say, 100,000 155 rounds every month, and we can only make 10,000, whatever the figures are, I know Scott and Doug have their fingers on it. What are we to do? We can't make them fast enough. I'm convinced that Pete Hegseth went to Trump, the Secretary of Defense went to Trump and told him, you got to stop this because you're bleeding down our assets so dramatically that if we were to go to war with China or someone else that had reasonable defense capability, we'd be in a real pickle. And that's what got Trump to stop some of the flow into Ukraine and to turn it over to the Europeans and to say things like, well, we'll give them the equipment, but the Europeans will make sure they get it, or we'll take it out of their warehouses or whatever. That's all hogwash. Europe and America together couldn't match Russia, let alone Russia and China in terms of defense industrial base. They swamp us, Nima. They absolutely swamp us. And I doubt anybody's really given a good briefing to Donald Trump. One, he won't sit down for it long enough on the defense industrial base. But whether it's THAADs or PAC-3s, Patriot missiles, or any kind of weapon system that would be critical to the United States and its ability to defend itself, let alone attack another country like China or Russia, is just inadequate. It's completely inadequate. And Nima, it would probably take, if it could be done, and I have done some study in this, and I've had students do a little work on it, it would probably take 2 to 3 years before we could even, and major decisions to divert spending to the defense industrial base and not to contractors like Lockheed and RTX as the way we're doing it now. I'm talking about really build up a shipbuilding base, a submarine building base, an airplane building base, all the kinds of things we did, say, in 38, 39, 40, and 41 to become the arsenal for democracy, which is really the way we won World War II. It wasn't on the battlefield. We won World War II by supplying the Soviets, the Free French, the British. We supplied everybody amongst the United Nations, the Allies. That's the way we did it. We couldn't do that today, Nima. We couldn't because we're broken. We're broken in terms of that kind of industrial base. So in order to build it back up again, it would be, we double our debt. We're going to be at $50 trillion in another 8 years. It's about $39 trillion right now. We would be almost, I would say, incapable of doing that today. That's how badly off we are in terms of that sort of defense industrial base. We looked at it hard when Powell became chairman and I was a special assistant in 1989. 91, 92, we looked at the defense industrial base as well as the forces we were cutting by 25%. And we saw the mismatch. If we went ahead into the future and went down to the number of contractors we knew we'd go down to, suffered the monopolistic tendencies that would breed, and suffered the economic competition that would eliminate a lot else. And we said, whoa, give it 20 years, we're going to be in trouble. We're going to be in serious trouble. Well, we're in serious trouble. We're in serious trouble.
Larry, we've learned, here is from media, we've learned that Iran is somehow beefing up its air defense system because they believe that finally Israel wants to attack them. Here is what we've learned. It says that Iran has actually they have the S-400 air defense system. They have somehow they were testing this air defense system S-400, the Russian one, in Isfahan, near Isfahan. You know that the Iranian nuclear facility in Isfahan, I believe they're talking about that region. And do you, when it comes to the attack on Iran, with what we've learned, and we don't know the reality, the naked reality of what's going on, what has happened during the war, 12 days of war, with the case of how the process of deciding how the United States, Donald Trump, has decided to interfere. We can speculate on that and the extent of damages that have been done to Israel Do you feel that would be a viable choice for Israel to go again and fight Iran?
Only if we were there maximally. And go back to what I was just talking about and apply it to this scenario. And even if we were to come in whole hog, the major thing we would come in with, if we weren't absolutely insane, is aircraft. Because we do have a lot of aircraft, just as Israel has a lot of aircraft. And it comes from local areas. It comes from Al Udeid, King Khalid, and other places in Saudi Arabia. And it would come from aircraft carriers. But there's a big question mark, because the only way you get air power from aircraft carriers on a sustained basis is to have a minimum of three carriers. People asked Powell why he took five carriers to the Gulf in the first Iraq war. And he said, very cavalierly but smartly, he said, because it didn't have six. He would have liked to have had six. If you have three carriers, you can generate 24-hour operations. That is if you don't lose one. Well, let's throw a wrinkle in there. The first thing that's going to happen is if we really confront Iran with a three-carrier battle group in terms of air power, they're going to sink one or two of those carriers, because their hypervelocity missiles are going to get through the screen that the carriers carry with them, with their escorts, submarines, and other things, and they're going to sink the carriers. Then Donald Trump's got a new decision to make. You got 10,000 Americans dead or in the water. You got a real decision to make there. This isn't the Red Sea. This isn't Al-Ansar, the Houthis. This isn't a localized small battle from which you can retreat before you take too many losses. You've just lost 10,000 Americans. So there are so many variables in this kind of conflict. But the essence of your question is, yes, we could come in with aircraft alone, both carrier-based and land-based. I suspect we'd do mostly land-based for the reasons I just articulated. And we could keep that going for quite a while. But bombs, Nima, do not win wars. Bombs do not win wars. The Iranians would get madder and madder and madder, ride all that out, and then retaliate. Israel's gone. Gone. Poof. In a puff of smoke, Israel's gone. Do we want that to happen? Does Donald Trump understand this? If Donald Trump were even presented it, could he absorb it? Because he is not the kind of person who impresses me with his intellect. So, and this is some fairly sophisticated military reasoning. You are going to lose if you join Bibi. But Bibi is going to be insistent, if he starts this again, that the United States join, because that's the only possibility he has of staying in power and the only possibility he has of saving his state other than going to nuclear weapons. And if he does that, all bets are off, because then he will be destroyed.
Yeah.
This is not an easy situation. I've war-gamed it. I've been with people who've war-gamed it in far more sophisticated ways than I, like General Van Riper. I've talked with them. I know what it's like for the United States if we decide to mount the state of Iran with forces, or even if we try to do it with air power alone, both sea-based and land-based. We're dead at the end of it. And Israel has disappeared. And guess what the Arab countries, once they saw Israel going down, would do? Guess what that chicken shit guy in Amman would do? He would even mount his tanks. Sisi would mount his tanks. Lebanon would at least rise up with the remnants of Hezbollah. And probably Syria would join in. And maybe even that stupid coward in Ankara, who is, you know, kowtowing still to the United States, but makes comments otherwise. Maybe he might join in, because he would see that that was the winning side. So we're talking about a true mess for the empire, and a mess that, once again, Bibi Netanyahu has created for us.
Thank you so much, Larry. Great pleasure.
It's all dismal, isn't it? It's just dismal. It's so dismal. I get up in the morning and have a cup of green
tea.
It's
not about us. It's about the reality outdoors.
And this situation in Gaza is just horrible. It's absolutely horrible. When I think of my country being associated with that and not doing anything about it, I'm revolted.
It's difficult. I don't know how can we talk about
God. Brings you to tears, doesn't it? Yeah, exactly. And you watch what that young gentleman, that former Green Beret, was saying. He was in tears, and I don't blame him for being in tears. That humans could do this to other humans is unconscionable.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Carl.
Surely.
Great pleasure, as always.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Tell Lula I said hello.
Yeah.
He doesn't remember this, but he sent his foreign policy advisor to help us when we were in, where were we at that time? I think we were in Havana that time. We were later in Sao Paulo, but he sent, and the first thing he said to me, I'm a Marxist. Can you deal with me? I said, of course. All my Cuban colleagues are Marxists. Anyway, tell him I said hello if you see him. Take care.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.